Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Jeffrey Kay. He's the author of the book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. I'm delighted now to welcome Lori Santos. She is a professor of psychology at Yale University. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you study capuchin monkeys, who I guess live in New Haven in a laboratory setting with you and your colleagues. Mm-hmm. Why do you study primates to learn about human psychology, non-human primates?
Well, the problem with studying humans, is particularly adult humans, is that they kind of know too much in the sense that they've already lived a life full of experiences and they have lots of abilities that make it tricky to get at what's really going on. You know, so we have language, we can kind of communicate this way, we have all these tools like iPhones and calculators and so on. If you really want to know where cognition came from and sort of the roots of some of this stuff, you actually have to turn to different populations. So some of my colleagues actually study human infants, which is a wonderful population because they, you know, they're a human species, of course, but they lack the kinds of experiences we have. We take less of a developmental route and more of an evolutionary route, turning to primates because, you know, now they're adult organisms, so they've had a lifetime of experiences, but lack really human-specific stuff. So it's a wonderful way, a nice window into what our cognition would look like if we didn't have all these human-specific kinds of experiences.
We have human-specific socialization, but they have monkey-specific socialization,
exactly.
Don't they?
And so they, particularly our guys, you know, they grow up in this big social enclosure with their natural family groups. You know, the idea is that they're living naturally as much as we can in captivity for capuchin monkeys. What they lack is very human-specific stuff. So from the perspective of economics, you know, they lack growing up in a culture with advertising and credit cards and this sort of thing. So they provide this wonderful population because they've had, you know, the right experiences to socialize them to be a normal adult organism. They just lack this really specific stuff. But that allows us to ask, you know, what of this specific stuff actually matters for who we become as adult humans.
Now, one of the things they seem to have and that they're good at is deception and theft.
Yeah, it's kind of sad that, you know, our poor monkeys are making a name for themselves, you know, ripping us off, as it were. But
they rip each other off or just more their laboratory captors?
No, they're very good at ripping each other off. I mean, one of the things about growing up in a natural world as a primate is that, you know, you have access to only very limited resources. Oftentimes, primates grow up in this really strict hierarchy, which means there's one individual who's the alpha male who kind of controls access to goods and services. If you're not the alpha male, then to gain access to those things, you often have to do so very deceptively.
And one of the things that apparently they're really good at is figuring out when you are distracted and stealing your stuff, or when each other is distracted, the other monkeys, and stealing your stuff when you're not paying attention.
Yeah, we actually came up with this line of work really surreptitiously. We were actually studying something else, I think, you know, what the monkeys know about number and so on. And we'd had many days of testing monkeys at our field site where we'd have to go home early because, you know, while we were writing something in our notebook, a monkey would, you know, rip off all the lemons we were using to conduct our studies. And we said, well, hang on, maybe this is actually more of an interesting ability than, you know, the kind of thing we were studying. So we set out to actually determine, you know, what do they know about deception? You know, when do they decide to deceive us and so on?
You know, I have to say, my dogs, well, especially one of them, knows exactly the same thing. I mean, he will wait to take the cheese off of the table and tell him I'm talking on the telephone.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is that this is a pretty widespread ability across lots of different animals, particularly social animals like primates and also domesticated dogs. It seems like both dogs and primates are really cued into where eyes are pointing, what you know and hear. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, the way they use that is often to deceive us in cases of dogs stealing things off tables or primates having, you know, low-ranking primates having surreptitious matings behind a tree so they won't get caught by the alpha male. So, you know, these are useful abilities, you know, both for human and non-humans.
I was in Indonesia last year, and I noticed that the dog culture there was very different from dog culture here. Mm-hmm. Here, when dogs meet each other, they're kind of like middle-class dogs who meet and greet, and over there, it's a completely different thing. So among monkeys, among the primates that you study, what kind of social or cultural differences do you have between one group of capuchin monkeys in one place and another place? Maybe one's in a laboratory, one's in the wild.
Yeah, it's a great question, and actually one that's relatively understudied. Often when you work with these groups of animals, there are only small numbers of individuals, so it's often hard to compare whether the noise you're seeing and the differences are really big differences across cultures or actually differences, you know, just in the idiosyncrasies of the individuals you work with. But those who work with wild populations have actually seen really interesting cultural differences across different groups of primates that have been studied, particularly chimpanzees, where you see different tool use traditions, different kinds of social traditions across the different populations. One of the neat things about that work is it seems like those differences aren't due to just ecological differences. So in other words, it's not just that one group doesn't use a tool because they don't have access to those materials. The differences, as far as we can tell, seem to be richly cultural for these apes that folks are studying.
So basically, somebody figures something out and they pass it on, and just like in human culture,
that
grows
exactly
and develops.
Right. Yeah, and so one of the questions is why you don't, the psychologists refer to this phenomena of ratcheting. So you get more and more and more technological innovation over time. Other animals, particularly other apes, seem to have this. The question is why it doesn't ratchet as far as it does, of course, in human cultures where, you know, no other species on the planet is, you know, doing what we're doing right now, talking to each other. You know, none of them are doing what your listeners are doing, which is using technology to kind of hear other people that they can't see. You know, so the question of why other species never get to that point is actually a very interesting one, and one for which we don't have a great answer yet.
So how far have you gotten with studying that
with
question?
These kinds of questions?
Yeah.
So primate researchers have actually figured out a couple interesting things. One is it seems like humans, more so than other primates, are really slaves to watching others act. So there's a set of studies, both with human children and with chimpanzees, where you give these populations some tool that they can't figure out. So it's usually kind of some opaque puzzle box that they have to use a tool to open. And because of the opaque nature of the box, it's not easy to figure out how this thing works. And what you find is that in that case, both chimpanzees and young human children will imitate the actions that they see others take, which is a smart strategy because if you don't know how it works, watching the way others act is pretty good. But now you mix it up a bit. Now you give chimpanzees and children the same puzzle box, but the whole box is clear. So now it's really obvious how it works. And what both of these populations can see is that you actually don't need to use the tool in the way that this actor is using the tool. So you see someone act on this box and you realize they're acting in a really stupid way that doesn't matter for actually operating the box. What you see with chimpanzees, when they get to use the box, they just use what they know and figure it out. They ignore completely what the person does. But human children, interestingly, do something else. They actually slavishly copy what they see another person do, even though they can articulate to you that it's a stupid way of going about doing something. So the claim is it seems like there's something about humans that really takes into account what other people are doing, almost in a very slavish way, where we can't avoid copying others. You know, this is stupid in the context of, you know, the experiments that we set up, which make, you know, human children.
Yeah,
in this
it makes chimpanzees look smarter than their
than
human
kids.
Counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, but oftentimes where we find ourselves imitating is in cases where, you know, we might not know how things work and so on. You know, probably none of us would be able to figure out, you know, how an iPhone or a computer or a car worked if we didn't have lots of people showing us. You know, we live in a causal world that's way more complex than other species have. But it might be this kind of dumb, very slavish mechanism that gives us the culture as we see it in humans. You know, if we grow up with this ability to kind of slavishly copy, it means we're better at copying and sort of more flexible, perhaps, than other species in their imitation and cultural learning.
I wonder if human beings could learn to have both sets of skills, both the slavish copying and the just getting to the answer right away.
And the shutting off. Yeah, so this is actually one of my students, Derek Lyons, has been focused on this. You know, what are the contexts under which you can shut this phenomena off? So he's called this over-imitation, kind of imitating, you know, sort of for the sake of imitating. And it seems like, at least in children, it's actually hard to really shut off and has big consequences. So watching someone act on an object can change the way you think the object physically works. It can change how you think about the causal properties of this object. So it suggests that our social knowledge can really override our physics in these funny ways. So again, this is an area that, you know, I think folks are working on to try to figure out, but it, you know, it's one of these things where we see this big difference across species and we're not entirely sure yet why, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's very interesting because we think of ourselves as the most rational animal, but what you're saying would indicate that we're highly irrational in that we look to the social group more than we look to the phenomenon at hand.
Yeah, I mean, in so many different contexts, what we're learning is that, you know, humans aren't as smart as we think. We often use these really quick rules of thumb, whether it be watching someone else or paying, just using some sort of quick and dirty strategy. I think the most ironic thing is that not just that we use these strategies, is that we refuse to believe that we're irrational. We like to think of ourselves as, you know, kind of maximally smart and maximally rational and flexible. And when you actually do the right studies, it seems like we might not be. You know, embarrassingly, we might be worse than other animals sometimes in this regard as well.
We're talking to Professor of Psychology Lori Santos. We want to talk about the lecture that you're giving tonight, at least to some extent, the evolution of monetary irrationality.
That's right.
It's at 6:30 tonight at the New Mexico History Museum. So you actually taught your wonderful, cute monkeys, who are all named after James Bond characters. I don't know if you guys think of them as cute, but they're so cute. You taught them to use currency. You gave them little coins and taught them to basically, I don't know about sell, but to buy their food.
That's right. And the shocking thing about this work is when we got into it, we just sort of asked, you know, can we get monkeys to do this? What we were really impressed by is how quickly they were able to do it. So the monkeys picked up that, so we introduced monkeys to these little metal washers. They kind of look like little quarters, and just train them that they can use them to pay for food from human experimenters.
How did you do this? I mean, how do you communicate with them?
Really, what the way we got did the, so with the tokens was just to give them the tokens and have a human experimenter standing there who's kind of holding a nice piece of food that the monkeys want. And they're curious creatures, right? So they'll pick up the tokens and kind of investigate them. And then, you know, a savvy experimenter can kind of sort of force them to do a quick swap with the token and, you know, grab the token and hand over the food. And really as quickly as that, they pick this up, like, aha, these tokens can be traded for food.
Do they understand human language at all?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, so one of the trickiest things about this line of work is actually figuring out a way to ask monkeys things. You know, it's easy to do these kinds of studies with adult humans, harder when you're working with nonverbal critters. So it really is just, you know, giving them these opportunities and trying to see if they can pick up the insight to do this task we want them to do.
So you taught them to use currency, and so you traded an apple for a little washer coin thing.
That's right. And then what we really wanted to do is to see, you know, did we just do a little cute, you know, trick with these monkeys where we get them to do this, or is this really like a currency to them? So I teamed up with an economist, Keith Chen, at the School of Management at Yale, and we actually asked, does their market obey the kinds of formal rules that human markets obey? So rather than just have them trade with one person, we put them in a market. So now there's multiple people offering multiple different kinds of food at different prices, basically different amounts for a single token.
So the Yale psychology department is the sellers of food.
Exactly. Actually, it's more my wonderful Yale undergraduates each get to be, you know, their own little shop for the monkeys. You know, so you'll have the blue experimenter who'll be, you know, in blue clothing, and there'll be a specific undergrad who sells thing at a particular price. You might have the pink experimenter who sells, you know, a different kind of food at a slightly different price.
So they see colors and associate that with the
That's right. We also, it's always a different specific individual, which is helpful because the monkeys, I think it's sort of natural for them to track, oh, what does this guy sell? Oh, he sells such and such. So the monkeys get to trade with that particular person for a while, so they learn what his, you know, prices are and what he sells. And then they go into a market where they get a choice between different experimenters. And the remarkable thing is that if you expect, you know, monkeys should, you know, maximize their token dollar, you know, they should respond when things go on sale and buy more and that sort of thing, all of the things you expect people to do rationally, the monkeys did as well.
So example
is if they have a choice between one experimenter who's selling apples at a very cheap price and one who's selling apples at a more expensive price, they'll selectively shop at the guy who's giving apples cheaper. They also respond to sales. So in a market where somebody's selling apples and somebody's selling grapes, you know, at a particular price, the monkeys might pick, you know, half apples and half grapes. But if suddenly apples go on sale and you can get a lot more apple for your token, the monkeys kind of switch consumption, as an economist would say. Basically, they buy more of the cheaper good. So the remarkable thing for us is when you look at the monkeys' behavior using the math that economists use to describe human behavior, basically the monkeys look exactly like a human, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Like the numbers really match the way you expect people to behave. And so this was remarkable to us. It suggested what we'd done wasn't just, you know, some trick where we had monkeys trading tokens. We'd really introduced them to something that they treated like a real human economic market.
And they also did some of the same irrational things that we do.
Yeah, so that was what we really were interested in. You know, if we give them this market, can we see the same kinds of errors that people make? And a lot has been made of, you know, the kinds of errors that people make in financial markets these days with the current, you know, housing crisis and, you know, quote-unquote economic collapse and so on. So we tried to target the...
Well, it's not only mistakes they make, but it also gets back to another monkey quality, which is deception and theft.
Exactly, and trying to look at whether or not they'll use this market to deceive us in the same kinds of contexts and so on. We started with a bias that economists have made a lot about in humans, which they refer to as loss aversion. And this is this idea that rather than see things just in terms of, you know, the overall benefit and so on, we actually really pay attention to the status quo and whether some option or decision will change us either negatively or positively relative to the status quo. And it turns out that people really hate going into the red. They work really hard to avoid being in the red. They get riskier when they think they're dealing with losses. And this sort of thing contributes to some of the stuff we see, you know, really in the market today. So one of the current problems in the housing market is that people see the status quo as their current house price now. So when they think about selling it, and it often sells less than the current price because prices have decreased to a certain extent, people choose not to sell and they choose not to lower their price. The same is true in the stock market, where people are really averse to selling a stock for less than they bought it, even though the stock's tanking. And this sometimes means that people hold on to stocks that are losing out longer than they hold on to stocks that are gaining. So it seems like this loss aversion actually affects human markets a lot. We wanted to see if the monkeys did the same thing. So we gave them a choice between experimenters. Some experimenters gave food at rates that were expected. Some started off with a slightly high status quo. So they showed the monkeys, look, there are two pieces of food available, say. But when the monkeys paid them, only one of the pieces of food was delivered. And so the idea is it's still, you know, a piece of food, it still should be good. But, you know, if the monkeys treat this problem like we treat the problem, they might see it as a case of, I was expecting so much and this feels bad. And so what we found was that the monkeys actually avoided experimenters who gave them less than the status quo expectation, even when those experimenters were actually giving a pretty good deal in terms of the amount of food. So it seems like the monkeys are also willing to potentially forego good food options that they see as losses. You know, basically the same kind of bias or strategy that leads to, you know, houses not selling on the market and, you know, keeping stocks that are doing badly and so on.
Now, all of this obviously has some kind of evolutionary significance. What equivalents of economic markets do we have in the wild?
Yeah, it's a big question, and we really don't know the answer. One idea is that, because of course we didn't evolve these strategies specifically for markets, they haven't been in our species long enough for even us to use these strategies specifically for that. But what we think is that the animals might actually have been using these strategies specifically in the social domain to figure out, you know, how much food should I forage for today? You know, it's not clear at absolute amount how much you want, but you can use, you know, what other people have as a reasonable guesstimate of what your status quo should be. And if you get less than others, then, you know, this is something you should pay a lot of attention to and work hard to deal with and so on. It's also relevant in the domain of kind of fairness and how much, you know, if I groom you, you know, X amount today and you groom me less than X amount tomorrow, you know, that might be the kind of thing you want to pay attention to and, you know, decide whether you should be in the market for grooming with this person in the future and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting because people use market metaphors to describe all sorts of things
social
in their lives, social interactions, and, you know, not only the job market, but they talk about it in terms of, you know, human relationships and dating and all that kind of stuff. It's all markets. And I've always had kind of an aversion to that. But when I hear you talk, I think, well, maybe it's more natural than I ever thought.
Yeah, it's also kind of the flip of it is that, you know, these things were the real markets. You know, we threw in these kind of weird currencies and specific numbers to it. But we must have had a way in our evolutionary past to compute, you know, who was giving us more in terms of grooming or kind of, you know, social support or, you know, even kind of time and listening to our gossip. You know, all of these things are the kind of things we needed to compute in real social relationships. You know, it's now that we have these market terms that we apply to that stuff, but it, evolutionarily, it might have been the reverse, that the social factors came first and economics later.
We were talking to the head of the Office of Archaeology for the state of New Mexico last, I think it was last week or the week before, and he was talking about how human populations have migrated and succeeded and failed and stuff like that in the Southwest. And one of the things that I was sort of horrified to find is that virtually every human society or subculture operates on boom-bust cycles.
Yeah.
Is it the same in animals?
It's a great question, and one that we're not really, you know, sure how to answer. The question is how to measure what their boom and their bust really is. We in some sense set up our own booms and busts by creating these sort of resources that we can kind of deplete and that are meaningful. It seems like animals have the capacity to set these kinds of things up, but whether they really destroy societies in the same way is not clear. I mean, the good thing about non-human animals is that they tend to use resources that really are, you know, real resources, you know, whereas humans set up status and hierarchies based on all kinds of very funny, you know, often meaningless things like, you know, currency and what kind of shoes we wear and these kind of extremely funny goods. You don't see those as much in non-human animals. But there are a couple of these really interesting cases, and they're often in the case of males trying to impress females in order to get the females to mate with them. And these are the spots where you see these really weird goods coming online. So there's the case of bowerbirds, which are these birds in Australia and New Zealand, in which the males kind of collect these treasures with which to impress females. They create these little art display cases and put out different goods. And the different species actually have their different things that they find very valuable. So the satin bowerbird really likes blue things, for example, so they kind of go out and collect as many blue things as possible. But they're really meaningful things to the animals. So the males aren't providing a nest or, you know, any sort of parental care or anything like that. They're really just, you know, making this cute little aesthetic thing that the females like to look at. You see this in a couple other species. There are fish species in which males build sandcastles and tried to build bigger and bigger sandcastles to impress the female. Again, the females aren't going to live in these castles or raise their offspring in them or so on. They're just, you know, the kinds of weird things we do to impress each other. So you see these in really restricted cases in other species. In our own species, of course, you see this, you know, widespread, and that what the unit is differs across cultures. But
cars and clothes.
Yeah,
and
cars and shoes or sneakers and this sort of thing. But for the most part, animals stick to real goods that matter for their survival and reproduction. It's just our weird species that has the luxury of kind of doing things really differently.
What are the gender relations like between the monkeys that you are studying in your lab?
Mm-hmm. It's so the monkeys in our lab are capuchin monkeys, and you know the genders are pretty standard for primates. So there's a single alpha male who kind of, you know, is the guy that all the females want to mate with, and so on. They have a pretty strict hierarchy that dictates who gets goods and services, and so on. We've been really interested in whether we see any gender differences in the financial markets that we set up for the monkeys. Problem is, we have very few of them that are in these markets. We only have 6 monkeys, so it's hard to see, you know, whether there are big sex differences. But one of the most compelling things we've seen is that we have one monkey who's extremely risk-seeking. So he always chooses the gambling option whenever there is one available, and he's our alpha male. So it seems like there might be some really interesting differences in, you know, personalities and perhaps gender and how that drives their financial choices. Right now, we don't have a big enough sample to look at that in detail, but there are hints that some interesting things are going on, and they kind of might map onto human-like things, you know. So when you think of, you know, who would correspond to the human alpha male, they tend to be, you know, the high-risk guy in a suit, you know, who's doing banking and so on.
Right. Well, you could convert an entire residential college at Yale into a monkey colony and get hundreds of them.
I would love to get funding to do this kind of thing, but, you know, it's a little tricky, but yeah.
Do you have to keep a kind of clinical distance from your monkeys, or do you fall in love with them the way we fall in love with our pets?
They're unlike our pets, which are domesticated and kind of built for being, you know, cute and cuddly with us. I mean, the monkeys really are wild creatures, you know, so they're not as lovable as you might think of a particular dog or cat kind of pet. But that said, I mean, they each have their own unique personalities. They're ones that, you know, you sort of resonate with their personalities and those that you don't. If you ask my Yale undergraduates, they could all tell you immediately who their favorite monkey was and why that monkey was their favorite and so on. So on the one hand, you have to keep a certain distance from them, you know, to maintain kind of healthy relations with your subjects. But on the other hand, like, they're real individuals with differences, and, you know, you kind of get to know and like some of them and not others.
And do they bond with you?
To a certain extent. I mean, they definitely recognize us and know who we are. One of the things that the undergraduate students always dislike is that, you know, in some of these economic studies, you know, we're often being very risky with the monkeys, or, you know, some of the experimenters represent losses. So they show the monkeys they're going to give something and they give less. And I can tell you that none of my undergraduates ever want to be the loss experiment, or they're convinced that the monkeys recognize them and, you know, dislike them.
They're not going to like me anymore.
Exactly. So, you know, you have to kind of cajole them into actually doing this. But
do you having worked so much with primates, when you go to, say, I don't know, a party or a faculty meeting or something like that, do you see us more as primates?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the amazing thing is that we don't just see this so automatically as well. I mean, but, you know, everything from, you know, hierarchy to the deception to just subtle ways that we socially influence each other. You know, I can't help watching other humans without thinking of them as being primates. I teach a course at Yale called Sex, Evolution, and Human Nature, where we really try to look at the evolution of humans and how natural selection built our nature, but also how our role as a sexually reproducing species actually affects us. And I can tell you my undergraduates leave this course and I think they have the same curse that I do, where they can't help but go back to their dorm room or the dining hall and not see these behaviors playing out.
Exactly. Laurie Santos is a professor of psychology at Yale University. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
I'm happy now to welcome Jeffrey Kay. He's a veteran journalist, longtime PBS correspondent, and author of the new book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the issues around immigration, as you write about in your book, are economics. To understand it, you have to basically, as they say, follow the money. This is a worldwide phenomenon, and as you put it, it's not even just a human phenomenon. We've been migrating since we were amoebas.
Yes, definitely, and that's something that we don't recognize. I think, you know, the first migration probably happened when little creatures crawled out of the primordial bogs in search of better food, better shelter. And ever since humans came into existence, have migrated around the world from East Africa. So we've all come from someplace, and we continue to go from someplace to somewhere else, depending on the calculations that we all make about whether our lives might be improved if we move, and depending on other circumstances that will either push us out or pull us in.
In the world as it exists now, the migration of labor is dependent very much on where jobs are, where opportunities are, and in many countries, not just in the United States, migrant laborers, immigrant laborers do what you call the 3D jobs. Mm-hmm. What are the 3Ds?
Well, dirty, dangerous, and demeaning. Those, you know, obviously in our country, we're used to people doing construction work, working in the fields, doing nursing jobs, cleaning babies' bottoms, taking care of old people, doing all the kinds of things that so-called regular Americans, as it's been put to me, won't do or won't get paid what they want to do. And the same is true across the world.
And the same is true across the world, yeah. It's funny, I was in Germany some years ago, and the birth rate in Germany is declining so precipitously, and they've been importing people from India to do high-tech jobs, and Conservative Party was trying to encourage people to have children so that they wouldn't have to import Indians.
Right. Well, it's an issue in every developed country where there's an aging population. And so one of the solutions, in quotes, that people come up with is let's bring in migrants to take care of us for when we get older. It's a little short-sighted because who's going to take care of the migrants when they age? It's also a little selfish, I think. If we just look at migrants for the labor they can provide to us, we're really not looking very generously at how to solve a dilemma, an issue.
Which is, at its root, both an economic and a human rights issue.
Sure. I mean, any time that you see people as laborers and laborers only, who are going to improve your society, that becomes a human rights issue. In Dubai, where I went, in the United Arab Emirates on the Persian Gulf, is sort of a classic extreme example of what happens when you rely so heavily on migrant labor, where 80 to 90% of the people who work there come from someplace else to do everything from the 3D jobs to the high-skilled jobs, whether it's computer work or management. They're in every single occupation, but it's a society that is entirely dependent on migrant labor. And at the bottom, you've got people who are brought in from India, Pakistan, South Asian countries, who basically have to work off debts. They're indebted servants who can work off debts that they paid to recruiters from the countries they came from, and can be working off those debts sometimes for 2 or 3 years before they actually make any money to send home to family, which is why they're there in the first place.
Now, here in the United States, we have had cycles of immigration forever. I mean, the very first people who came over on the Mayflower were immigrants, and then we've had many, many cycles of immigrants ever since, and very widely differing policies on immigration.
Sure. But it's always been an issue. Ever since the colonists came, it's been an issue. I mean, the first migrant rights group were the colonists, who put in the Declaration of Independence their demand to the king that they be allowed to move beyond the prescribed boundaries. The king didn't want them to move out to do the kind of fur trading they wanted to do. So mobility has been an issue, will always be an issue. And we treat migrants, come to your question, very differently according to our needs and according to the economy. When the economy goes downhill, we notoriously will look to deport those people who are unwelcome, as we're doing right now. The Obama administration has set a record for deportations.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, people get very anxious, fearful when the economy is bad, and the first people they look around to blame, often as scapegoats, are migrants. It happened with the Chinese. It's happened time and again with Mexicans. We bring them in when we want them. When the economy goes bad, as happened with the Chinese, there were mobs all over California where the Chinese were primarily working in the mines and the gold rush days, to building the railroads, etc. When the economy went bad, there were riots in California, leading eventually to the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, the most drastic law that we've ever seen. I was in Arizona earlier this week doing research looking at some of the events that happened during that period when the Immigration Department, which interestingly was combined with the Labor Department at the time, had their Chinese inspectors, as they were called. And, you know, bear in mind, Arizona, which has obviously been in the news recently for its very extreme law, in my opinion, reading a headline from the 1920s, I think it was, after they arrested Chinese people who were here illegally, with the headline, "One Less Chink." Kind of a good lesson for us to think about in terms of...
Well, and the thing is, I mean, you... In your book, quote, 1983 U.S. News and World Report headlines about the Mexican invasion.
Yeah.
We haven't, I mean, we're still using those kinds of military metaphors for people who are basically on the whole. I mean, obviously there's the question of drug dealing at the border and stuff like that, but on the whole, looking for jobs in these dirty, demeaning, and dangerous kind of lines of work.
And of course, they're not all 3D jobs. We do have the high tech. I should have added that. But look, I lived in California during that period, and it's any change is unsettling for people. When you see signs going up, people speaking different languages, combining that with uncertain economic times makes people very nervous. People, you know, sort of jealously guard what they have, and are afraid often when others come in. It's sort of fear of the outsider, but it's always been with us. Benjamin Franklin had the same fear. Benjamin Franklin, notoriously, in my opinion, said when Germans were coming in to Pennsylvania, he was worried about the Germans kind of taking over and Germanizing what had been the Anglo population. When the signs started going up and contracts were being written in German, said eventually we're going to have interpreters in the legislature, so half the legislature could understand what the other half was saying. So this kind of fear has always been with us, whether people coming from Germany during the colonial times, or more recently people coming from, you know, early 20s, 30s, from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, who spoke funny languages.
We're talking to Jeffrey Kay, author of the book Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. What does the title of your book mean, Coyote Capitalism?
Well, you know what a coyote is, right? It's a slang term for a human smuggler. And the job of a smuggler is to get someone across the border safely and earn money by doing that. The coyote doesn't really care about the circumstances that may have motivated the migrant to come in the first place and doesn't really care about what happens to the migrant once they arrive wherever they're going. His job or her job is to get that person across the border and get paid for doing it. So I've sort of expanded the term to look at sort of a global system, if you will, using that term system very, very loosely, to explain how sort of the migrant engines work together in a global system that doesn't really care too much about the welfare of migrants, but nonetheless pushes them out, pulls them in, often joined in the middle by the recruiters or the smugglers, legal recruiters, illegal smugglers. Often they do exactly the same thing. So that's what I meant by coyote capitalism. It's not really caring too much about the fate of the migrants.
You know, the hostility toward immigrants that we see today, and not just in Arizona, it's not new. I mean, it's part of our history,
right.
And it often employs racist language. And you have very strange things where, for example, here in New Mexico, there's reports of hostility between Native Hispanic people and Mexican people who are of precisely the same race. There's no discernible racial difference of any kind, and yet there's still this kind of racism going on. Is there anything different about today's hostility toward immigrants in the U.S., or is it just business as usual?
I think it's business as usual. You know, I think that people who are here, wherever here is, have been here for a long time, feel a sense of pride and ownership and resentment of the newcomers who don't necessarily see common roots. And, you know, you gave one example of people who are Latino with common roots, but, you know, I think the same can be said just about anyone, you know, Irish, Italian, you name it. I think one of the things that we need to do is to think seriously about our common roots. To try to understand and try to put ourselves into the shoes of those people who are coming in today, whose motives are really not much different from either ourselves personally, I'm an immigrant myself, or ancestors who came for exactly the same reasons.
Yeah, I mean, when I hang out with Mexican immigrants in Santa Fe today, they are, for all the world, so much like my Sicilian grandparents,
yeah,
who came over from Sicily around the turn of the last
sure.
century. And it's interesting because in my own story, my grandfather went into the garment business, and his mentors were Jewish immigrants
sure.
who came over before he did.
Sort of an entry-level occupation. Yeah.
And he learned to speak Yiddish.
Right.
And so you have a Sicilian speaking Yiddish, and you've got all sorts of... I mean, and what I wanted to ask you about in relation to that is, do you find that recent immigrant groups are more open to the next wave of immigrant groups?
No, not necessarily. I think there is a sense of ownership and proprietary... and also, I don't think that necessarily those immigrant groups mingle or mix so much. Every city around the world has sort of an entry place that migrants gravitate to. And then when they start, I'm talking about in the developed world, and then when they start earning decent livings, they migrate out from there. So often the first generation doesn't necessarily mix with the second or third generation. But I think when you do put people together, there is an understanding. I remember covering a story for the NewsHour, about a fascinating cultural story about a klezmer group and a mariachi group that got together. Klezmer being the celebratory language of Eastern European Jews, mariachi the celebratory music of Mexicans. And they were playing duets together and learning each other's language and music. And there was a conversation going on as the group learned a Yiddish song called Grine Cousine, which is the green horn cousin. And the violinist who was playing for the klezmers, the mariachi guy came up and asked the violinist, well, what does this mean? And he explained what it is, green horn cousin, just arrived, and it's the story of new immigrants explaining... old immigrants explain to the new immigrants what things are all about. And there was an instant rapport with a mariachi player, himself an immigrant. Oh, yeah. They high-fived each other. And, you know, there's a we have all this stuff in common that we often don't recognize because we don't mingle and because we don't think about our histories.
What are some of the reasons when we talk about the globalized economy in which we live? There's this fantastic quotation in your book. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, you're in Dakar, and you said, at the port of Dakar, I watched as dock workers unloaded 50-kilogram sacks of rice from a boat and then loaded them onto waiting trucks. As Filipino sailors stood by, Senegalese stevedores removed Uruguayan rice from a Greek-owned ship operated by C-Corp, a Miami-based transnational company.
Right.
I mean, we live in this crazy globalized world. What are some reasons? NAFTA is one example, but what are some of the many reasons why people are pushed from one place to another?
Right. Well, interestingly, you should look at the Senegalese example. Senegal is the country on the sort of westernmost bulge of Africa. And there I met with people who had been or about to migrate or who were dealing with people who were migrating through Senegal to try to make it to Europe. Why? Much of the food that I mentioned in the quote that you mentioned, you referred to, had been coming in from abroad, subsidized by European governments. Farmers there could not compete with that cheap food. The people, the fishermen and women, had a hard time making a living because of the fish had been overfishing in the area, mostly by European trawlers and others. So here you have a sort of a global economy, fishermen going around the world, cheap food being exported to compete with domestic food. Just as in Mexico, where we ship cheap corn down to Mexico and the farmers there can't compete without cheap subsidized corn, and they migrate. So if you've got that kind of competition and no alternatives, you're pushing people out.
I think it's one of the real dark sides that a lot of people don't understand about so-called free trade,
right,
which is that if you've got a free trade policy and one country can afford to subsidize its farmers and the other country can't,
right
away you have a tremendous inequality that results in A, unfairness, and B, migration.
Right, exactly. And so bottom line, what I like to talk about is the fact that what we're seeing going on is an international fact. And that efforts to try to deal with migration, and every developed country is doing exactly the same thing, particularly in a down economy, trying to put up walls, get rid of their migrants, doing exactly what we're doing in the United States. But you can't deal with it in one city, one state, whether that's Arizona or any of the other 49 states, or nationally. No single nation can deal with it. By its nature, immigration is an international issue. It involves a border. And because it involves a border or many borders, it needs to be dealt with on a global or at least an international or a binational basis. And we're not doing that. We somehow think that Washington can solve the problem or the issue, and they're not going to be able to do that.
Well, and I think setting up what is the problem in the first place is a very big question. I've seen studies that say that immigrants pay taxes, even if they have a false Social Security number, they're still paying taxes, pay more into the system than they get out. I've seen other people say that they're a burden on the system.
Right.
What is the quote-unquote problem that we're dealing with?
Well, I think putting it as a quote-unquote problem is a good way of describing it. People will see the issue through different prisms and different lenses. I'm not an economist. But I tend to think, as you're indicating, that the contribution that migrants make to the economy is probably a lot more than they take out of the economy. Although it's really hard to quantify in terms of taxes, which is one measurement, but that's only one measurement. What often we fail to recognize is the price of the labor. And what would be the price of that labor were those migrants not here? But, you know, the deeper question, I think, is not so much the cost or the benefit of migrants, and that's something that always comes up again in a down economy. It's what's pushing people around and what's motivating people to leave, what kind of trade policies are in place, looking at wealth discrepancies and disparities between countries. Those are the kinds of things that I think we need to be thinking much more seriously about, is what causes migration, and then do something about that.
We're talking to journalist Jeffrey Kay about his book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. I've often wondered whether companies that use migrant labor actually are against, you know, quote-unquote illegal immigrant labor here in the United States, are against immigration reform because they can underpay and exploit immigrants if those people don't have any rights.
Well, look, companies, it's not just companies, it's individuals who use migrant labor, obviously, you know, in as nannies, as so, you know, it's across the board wherever migrant workers are needed.
Right.
Publicly, the companies that are frequent users of migrant workers are campaigning for temporary worker programs. They're tired, I think, of being under the microscope. Nonetheless, many of them admit, the agribusiness, for example, freely acknowledges that as many as 70% or even more of their workforce are here illegally. And they're certainly, you know, not, and to be fair, agribusiness has been involved in various efforts towards comprehensive immigration reform, but again, on a temporary worker basis, which is, I think, not where we need to be heading.
Where do you think we need to be heading?
Well, labor unions are against temporary worker programs without worker protection.
Right.
Where we need to be heading is towards sustainability. We talk about sustainable sustainability when it comes to green products and all the rest of it. We don't use that term as we should to talk about sustainable economies. Where we need to be heading and what we need to be thinking about is sustainable economies in both countries that send migrant workers and countries that receive them, like the United States. So for those 3D jobs that are dangerous and demeaning, we need to offer incentives and wages so that people will be incentivized to do the kind of jobs that are so valuable to our society. It's kind of nutty to me that the most valuable jobs we have, we expect to be done by someone else. Valuable in terms of building our buildings, taking care of our young people and our old people, and growing our food. Why is it that we haven't got a structure in place that Americans feel that they can take those jobs?
Jeffrey Kay's new book, Moving Millions, How Coyote Capitalism Fuels Global Immigration. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.